You got my back, though, right? She nods. And I owe you one for saving me down in the tunnel. Just don't try to cash in that favor anytime soon, yeah? Wasn't exactly planning on trading life-threatening situations with you. Morning smiles. We might not have much choice down here. Azima and Jamie lead us into the tower. I can already hear Katsu's laugh dominating the shared space. The group is slouched around a circular table in the middle of the room. I search the gathering for Isadora and breathe a sigh of relief when I don't find those rigid shoulders, that dark stare, the familiar crowned eight tattoo. Anton eyes the group before saying, "I need to get my beauty sleep." He walks toward Hive 3 with purpose. Maybe he's going to work on whatever plan they have brewing. Azima moves in the opposite direction, charmed forward by all the noise. A roar from Katsu's crew lures the rest of us in, too.
"Seriously?" Katsu complains. "This is unreal!"
It's a surprise to find one of the Imago with them, after Speaker just said they couldn't come inside. It's a bigger surprise to find Longway sitting down with the group, playing cards. And then, the surprise to end all surprises, Longway's actually smiling. He made such a habit of avoiding us on Genesis 11 that seeing him deal a hand of cards feels like sighting a mirage. Jazzy plucks up a single card before waving at us.
"Come on over, y'all," she says. "Ever play forehead stud?"
Alex has his golden curls pushed back by a headband. He grins and makes the name of the game clear by slapping a card against his forehead. Two of diamonds. Noor adjusts her black hijab and does the same, flashing the queen of spades. We stand around the table and watch as the others follow suit. Everyone but Longway.
"We wanted to teach Bally how to play," Katsu explains. "The sooner he knows which cards are which, the sooner I can start winning money off of him."
Bally holds a nine of clubs to his forehead.
"If we were playing for money, so far all of it would be in Longway's pockets. I spent all day with him and he didn't say a single word. But offer a little competition and he transforms into this."
We glance that way and find Longway with a playful hand hovering over his unturned card. Everyone waits in anticipation as he locks eyes with Bally.
"Are you worried I'll have the highest card again?"
he asks. Bally frowns.
"It seems statistically unlikely."
Longway lifts the card slowly to his forehead. We all lean forward, and the table erupts when the Ace of Spades appears. Alex actually stumbles to his feet and shakes Longway by the shoulders, like he just scored the winning goal in a soccer game or something. I laugh when Longway presses the card in and it sticks to his forehead. He raises both hands in triumph. Bally nods before standing.
"I think it is time for me to return to our camp before I get in trouble because Katsu forced me to come inside. Tomorrow I will teach you some of our games. We will see if your luck holds, Longway."
Longway dips his head in acknowledgement. The card flutters down to the table.
"I look forward to it, Bally."
The others lean back in their chairs as Bally exits. Katsu kicks his feet up on the table. I claim the seat across from him. Morning eyes the room again, and when she's satisfied Isadora isn't a present threat, decides to join us.
"Your dig go all right?" I ask. "No issues?"
Katsu shrugs.
"Same old stuff. Dig a hole, grab the Nixia, blah, blah, blah."
"It went well," Noor chimes in.
"Katsu's a good leader."
He waves the comment away.
"So, you haven't figured it out yet?"
He nods over to Longway and the others.
"I told you. I knew they wouldn't figure it out. The game was a distraction. But still, Morning, the proclaimed genius of Genesis 12, even she must bow before my eternal wit and wisdom and cunning."
Their group exchanges smiles. It takes me about 2 seconds to finally notice what's so different about all of them. Their smiles. I can actually see their full smiles.
"You're not wearing your masks."
"Emmett rings the obvious bell first," Katsu grins. "But now let's head into the uncharted territory where dwell the real mysteries. How the hell can you understand what I'm saying?"
I stare at them.
completely lost. Morning reaches for her mask and pulls it off.
You can understand me? She asks. Without the mask?
Katsu just smiles. We figured it out during our dig.
I don't get it, I say. How's that possible?
You don't speak English?
And you don't speak Japanese, he replies. Yet here we are, having a conversation with each other.
Nora's face brightens.
It's weird, isn't it?
Jazzy leans forward like it's the juiciest piece of gossip.
Here's my theory. Those masks, they retrained our brains, y'all. Maybe we just know things now. Like, I don't know. Like there was dormant knowledge that's woken up or something.
Or there is another explanation,
Longway suggests.
It only works with spoken language. I wrote down a few Chinese characters, and the others couldn't understand them.
I slide my mask off, but Katsu waves abruptly.
Emmett, actually we've had requests that you keep yours on. Longway and I remember how bad your breath smelled most mornings.
Longway shoots him a look, shocked to be implicated. I fling my mask at Katsu, and he barely manages to deflect it away.
I was just kidding, man! He shouts. Come on! You could have knocked a tooth out of this beautiful smile of mine.
The surprise and joy of the moment is swallowed by chaos near Foundry's entrance. My entire body goes rigid. Morning rises to her feet. But it's not Isadora. We can hear voices shouting as oppressive bodies fills the doorway.
Incoming!
Kit shouts.
Get her down to the med unit.
Omar's carrying the front half of a stretcher. Parvin and Ida are hefting the back end. It takes a few seconds to realize that Holly is sprawled out and unconscious. Isadora trails the group, followed closely by the three Imago escorts. Speaker's expression is full of horror.
What the hell happened?
Morning shouts.
Too much Nixia,
Omar calls back.
She accidentally manipulated a piece that was still connected to the rest of the mine. It pushed back, and she went down hard.
Speaker presses forward.
You need to let one of us attend to her.
The triage team marches through the living space to the back of the tower. Holly's always been pale, with a scatter of freckles on both cheeks, but now she looks downright ghostly. Morning starts to follow, before realizing there are too many bodies crowding around too narrow a hallway. And there's nothing we can do. We're not doctors. Katsu hisses a curse. The others crowd around, heads bowed, as Kit guides the team down into the med bay. I almost jump when I realize Isadora is standing a few feet to my left. She throws me a dark look before raising her hands innocently, like the accident has called to life a temporary truce. I nod back and the whole group takes seats, waiting for word from below. Morning sits beside me. She sets a hand over mine, and I realize for the first time that it's been shaking. We've lost too many people already. I've had one eye on Isadora and one eye in the rearview mirror, just counting all the ways Babel has wronged us. It was easy to forget how vulnerable we are down here. The creatures stalking the plane, Morning's accident in the tunnels, and now this.
She's going to make it, Morning says softly. She has to make it.
Chapter 9. Gripped. Emmett Atwater. Real tragedy always brings silence with it. A few people pace, but most of us sit our fears on elbows, waiting for the would-be doctors to surface with their diagnosis. Everything about the moment feels a little too close to home. The insomnia of waiting rooms, the sterile halls of hospitals. Morning and I exchange a few glances, knowing how close we were to being the ones brought home on a stretcher. It's so quiet for so long that Morning's whisper startles me.
We launched right before my birthday, she says. Missed it by a few days.
I glance back at her. Yeah?
It was my quinceañera.
I've been in one of those, for this girl from school. It's a huge party, right?
Morning nods. It represents the transition from childhood to womanhood. You wear a pretty dress and go to mass and your whole family is there. The way we do it up in our neighborhood, it's like one big block party. Mi abuelita was furious I was going to miss it.
Her eyes are still locked in the spot where Holly vanished. Did you see how young Holly looked? Morning shakes her head. Knocked out like that. She's just a kid. We're all supposed to be kids. I might not be wearing the pretty dress, but I know I'm not a child anymore. After all this, none of us are.
I lean back on the cushion so our shoulders are pressed together. I'm searching for the right words. But what she's wrestling with is what I've been wrestling with since Kaya died. I spent a long time weighing who deserved how much blame. Was it my fault, or was it Babel's fault? At the end of the day, though, what mattered was that Kaya was gone.
Mi abuelita always says you get one of two worlds. You either get the world you hope for, or the world you fear. When my name was on the top of the scoreboard, I thought all my dreams were coming true. I was gonna go back and change the world. But the longer we're out here, I'm not sure what kind of world I'm getting. We can't keep losing people. I can't lose you. I can't lose them.
Before I can respond, Speaker emerges. My heart sinks as I take in the posture of his shoulders and the look on his face. I've seen Pops look like that coming out of doctor visits as Mom's got worse and worse. Which is why it's a surprise to see Holly stride out behind him. The sight of her walking like nothing happened pulls the rest of us to our feet. The other Genesis members trail her, but their faces aren't excited or relieved. They look just as horrified as Speaker. I don't get it. Until I lock eyes with Holly. We didn't speak all that much on the ship, but there's something intimate about standing across from someone and trading punches. There are details you memorize as the adrenaline kicks in, as you dip shoulders and throw jabs. Holly's eyes were green. A light color like mint. Now, they're black.
Holly?
Morning's voice trembles.
What happened to her?
Speaker shakes his head. She was gripped by the substance. As we watch, Speaker stops walking. Holly pauses at the exact same moment. She looks over at him like she's waiting for a command. Something about that look and those eyes feels worse than death.
Gripped?
Morning echoes. To the eternal tasks, she will be compelled, Speaker explains. Compelled to perform useful tasks, preparing meals, cleaning rooms, fixing broken equipment. None of us have forgotten Babel's experiments in space. I can still see the line of Nixian objects, each one slightly bigger than the next. Every time the substance cut us away from the present, pulled us down with greedy hands. Was this what it was trying to do?
Eternal tasks?
Morning echoes. Speaker nods.
If we cannot free her, she will work in this world and the next.
The entire group flinches at that. I'm not sure where everyone else stands on the afterlife, but the idea of Holly working mindlessly to her death, and maybe beyond, has me completely shook. But you can fix her, I ask desperately. Right, Speak? There has to be... I let the sentence trail off as Holly lifts her head. We all watch as she turns mechanically and marches toward the kitchen. The group stumbles that way, keeping an eye on her as she reaches the cabinets. She takes up the nearest rag and starts wiping down the counter.
Damn, I whisper. This is so messed up.
Speaker shakes his head.
I am sorry. We didn't expect... It's very uncommon. Babel told us that you would be trained in manipulating Nixia. It was a point of emphasis in our negotiations. As outsiders, you're more vulnerable to the substance's pull. We made it very clear that there are limitations you must learn if you're to come here. We warned Babel.
She made a mistake, Omar says. I saw it happen. Just manipulated the wrong thing.
Morning's eyes sweep back to Speaker.
So what are you saying? That she's stuck like this? That doesn't work for us, Speaker. That person in there isn't Holly.
She is fortunate to be alive, Speaker replies. The gripped are a crucial part of our society, but it is a process that's usually done with great care and guidance.
I am amazed that she survived. There are ways to bring her back, but those methods are difficult. We should be able to treat her when we reach Seven Set.
So take her now, I suggest, earning a few looks. Treat her now.
Speaker exchanges a look with the other imago. The three of them come to a silent understanding before he responds.
We have to honor the treaty. She'll receive treatment, but only after Babel receives what we promised them. She's not in danger if she waits. You will just have to make sure she doesn't exert too much energy. She will only eat and drink if she is ordered to do so.
Morning looks frustrated by that answer. So does the rest of the group. In the kitchen, Holly's finished wiping down the counters and has started sorting through the cabinets, making sure everything is in order.
Speaker offers an apologetic look.
It would be irresponsible of me to not use this moment to warn the rest of you. Proceed with caution. Nyxia is a complex substance. I am hopeful for Holly's recovery. I do think there are ways for my people to restore her, but it will not be without difficulty. Please be as careful as possible when you work with the substance.
Morning nods a concession.
We fathom. It's late. Let's get some sleep. I'll stay with Holly for the first shift.
Parvin waves her off.
I'm her captain. She was my responsibility, is my responsibility. We'll set up a rotation with our group until she falls asleep.
The thought has Parvin frowning. She looks in Speaker's direction.
She will sleep, won't she?
He gives a nod.
Less than most, but yes, she will sleep.
The imago excuse themselves after that. I can hear them whispering together, clearly imagining this as a blow to the first week of negotiations. The rest of the group disperses too. Morning tries to say goodnight to Holly, but she ignores Morning as she restacks bowls in the upper cabinet. We cross back to Hive 3, and there's an undeniable grief hanging in the air. Anton and Jamie are already in their rooms, doors closed, probably sleeping. Today should have been a day of wonder and exploration. A day to remind us all that we're still here and we're still fighting, even after everything Babel's done. I saved Morning in the tunnel earlier. I discovered I can speak languages I have no business knowing. This new world's been full of miracles. But there are nightmares waiting for us here too. As I drift off to sleep, my dreams ignore the joys and victories of the day. I dream of Holly's pitch-black eyes. I dream of Rothi standing behind the Nyxian barrier I created, but this time, Isadora is standing with him. She raises a hand that's covered in green-black smoke. The two of them come for me, and there's nothing I can do.
Chapter 10. Behind the Curtain. Emmett Atwater. There's a second where dream becomes reality. Awake to darkness. There's a hiss for quiet. A figure hovering nearby. A dread in my chest that somehow Isadora has come for me. But it's Jamie. Jamie's in my room, crouched at the foot of my bed, and he's holding the side of his ribcage where the wound is.
Emmett, I need to go down to the medbay.
My heart pounds with relief. I sit up, half asleep, and start pulling my suit on. Jamie stands, but the motion costs him something. He lets out a muted grunt before limping to the door.
Here, I say, zipping up my suit. I got you.
With one of his arms draped over my shoulder, I move us through the door and out into Hive 3. At this hour, only a handful of lights have been left on. The far end of the common room is sheathed in darkness. The tunnel that leads back to the tower proper is a nest of shadows, too. I stare that way. Jamie draped over one side, and find myself hesitating.
Isadora went to bed,
Jamie says, reading my fears.
I didn't see her out there.
I offer him a tight nod and get us moving again. Jamie's words don't stop me from reaching for the Nyxie in my left pocket. I link my mind to it, like letting a mental hand hover over the handle of a holstered gun, just in case. There's no sign of Isadora in the common room, though. Only Holly and Parvin. Holly's asleep on one of the couches. Parvin's sitting up at the opposite end, and she's dozed off too. A single overhead light throws shadows in every direction. Jamie winces again, and I move him in the direction I saw them take Holly earlier. There, beneath the upward winding staircases, is a narrow ramp. It runs down 30 meters before hairpinning, 30 more meters, another turn. A cracked door offers us a sliver of light. Jamie nods us inside.
So what? It just started bleeding again? I ask.
I think I popped one of the stitches, he says. I just need some bandages.
The bright interior reminds me of the ship, the time I spent in the med unit because of Jamie. It wasn't his fault. Not really. All he did was accidentally punch a sword through my gut. Three gurneys are arranged in a half circle. There's a sink built into one corner, and stacks of medical supplies are sectioned into a makeshift shelving system. I'm eyeing the rows and rows of equipment when Jamie shuts the door.
Over there, he says. Second row on the far left.
I'm barely awake as I fumble through the rows and pull down a stack of bandages. A glance shows that Jamie's exhausted. He looks like he hasn't slept since landing.
How are you holding up, man?
Jamie shrugs his shirt overhead and starts picking at the current bandage.
He grits his teeth and pulls the thing off with a solid rip.
I'm fine. Everything is fine.
You sleeping?
He stares at me for a second.
I keep having nightmares.
I cross the room, nodding.
About Brett.
It takes a few seconds for me to blink the sleep away. I stand there, eyeing the wound. Blood has dried along the center section, but everything else looks normal. Jamie takes a deep breath.
I was always a good kid. I followed the rules. That's what you do where I come from. You follow the rules. If the crosswalk says don't walk, you don't walk. If it says you can only hunt during this season, you only hunt during that season. We're taught that if you follow the rules, you'll succeed. That's how life is supposed to work. Babel took the rules away. I don't know what to feel right now. It's like they showed me the worst of who I am.
I nod my understanding. I'm starting to see the difference between the two of us. It's not that I'm not mad. I haven't forgotten what Babel did to us. It's just that this has happened to me before. I'm used to a world that sells me a lie and pretends it's the truth. It's clear that, poor or not, Jamie never had someone do him this way. All the anger that's burning inside him used to burn inside me, and so my grandmother taught me how to file things away. But Jamie has no system for tracking this pain. It's too new to him.
Can you see anything?
Jamie asks.
Did one of the stitches open up?
I inspect the wound again and shake my head.
You're good.
I think you just tugged some of the skin between. New bandage should do the trick. He takes a piece of gauze and dabs at the wound. After a few seconds, he leans back and nods.
Get it on as tight as you can.
Dr. Atwater at your service, I say, lining up the bandage. It's easy work, and I take a step back when it's done. Jamie smooths the edges before pulling his shirt back on. I'm standing there, thinking about what my pops would say to me if I was in Jamie's shoes, when something catches my eye. Jamie's seated on the far left gurney. There are two others. On the floor next to the middle one, I see a series of scuff marks. It's the same detail I noticed aboard Genesis 11. The kind of detail that's just a little bit off, because down here, in a brand new med bay, why would there be scuff marks at all? Curiosity drags me to the spot. Definitely scuff marks. A ton of them, too. Someone's been visiting this exact location over and over. Jamie's finished pulling his jacket back on. He looks over confused.
What are you doing?
This spot. I shove the gurney aside. The overhead light plays tricks on the surface of the tiles. For a second, it looks like there's nothing, and I feel like I'm making it all up. I run a finger along the floor, though, and it snags. Finding one edge brings out the whole outline. A trap door. I trace a finger along the edges until it snags again. A little digging pops up a latch.
Secret room, I say.
Jamie offers me a dark look.
Of course they have a secret room.
I lean down and give the latch a solid tug. The entire panel gapes open. There's a hole leading down into the dark. We need to investigate. We need to see what Babel's hiding, even if this is just a route leading out to safety. But standing there on the threshold reminds me of the moment before Kaya and I entered Babel's torture chamber. We were curious. We did too much digging. I side-eye Jamie.
They have to go inside,
he says. We really don't. He shakes his head.
We can't beat them if we don't know what games they're playing.
I stare over at him. It's the kind of thing PJ would say. Jamie takes one look at me before lowering himself into the dark. I stand there, staring after him, and know that he's changed. On the ship, he never led the way in anything. He was a middle-of-the-pack performer from day one. Babel pushed him too far when they put Brett in the same escape pod as him. They activated some quiet part of Jamie that's always been there. He's becoming someone who takes action. Damn it! I crawl in after him. It's a narrow tunnel. Dark, too. But Jamie's movement sets off a motion light about 20 meters ahead. I force myself to not think about tight spaces, about being buried alive. Thankfully, the journey's not long. Jamie reaches the end of the tunnel, and we're facing a door with a hatch wheel handle. He gives it two spins, and then pulls. I'm not ready for what waits behind the door. I should have known. We all should have suspected. Babel has masks for their masks, curtains behind their curtains. The room is full of marines. Individual capsules run along the walls, framed by Nixia, hanging with flawless precision. Each capsule is fronted by glass casing, slightly fogged by frost. A different face stares down from each chamber. Women and men, light skin and dark, all tagged with the Babel emblem of a looming tower. I take a second to file this under C, for conspiracy. When I exhale for the first time, my breath mists in the air. It's almost freezing in here. Jamie moves forward until he's standing beside a central console. Blue light runs between the glowing numbers of the keypad. He eyes it for a second before looking back up at the faces.
How many of them are there?
Jamie asks.
Maybe 30 on each side? More?
Jamie looks up into the face of a sturdy-looking Marine. He has thin, graying hair and a small scar just above one eyebrow.
They're all asleep.
It's like in comic books, I say. Cryogenic chambers.
Just waiting to be activated.
Jamie says, glancing back at the console. Babel built them into the base, right under the Imago's noses. The sound of an echoing click has us both whipping around. Kit stands by the entrance, pistol raised like a professional gunslinger, eyes dead set on us. Chapter 11. The Backup Plan. Emmett Atwater. Kit steps inside the hidden room, eyes turning the scene over. It takes him about 2 seconds to realize we're the ones responsible for the breach. My heart hammers in my chest. But Kit's shoulders relax. He lowers the weapon and sets it back in the holster.
Oh, he says, smiling. It's just you.
Jamie and I exchange a glance as he comes sliding forward, gesturing to the walls around us.
Pretty cool, isn't it? Babel never ceases to amaze.
I glance Jamie's way again. He's a mix of confusion and anger. Clearly, he doesn't know how to approach this new development. I decide to take the reins.
Like something from an episode of the Illuminats, man. Never seen anything like it.
Kit's eyes widen.
You're not gonna believe this, but that's all I've been watching down here. Just finished season 7. You know, the one where they go back in time to find the captain?
You've got access to your Neverland account down here? Kit smiles at that.
We're not that advanced. I just chose a few uploads before launching. They knew I'd be alone down here. I've been binge-watching it for a while. You guys want to catch a few episodes?
I gesture back to the walls, to the sleeping Marines.
Why watch it when you're living it?
Kit smiles even wider.
Fair enough. Yep. I come down here and visit them every few days.
They're the closest thing to company I've had at the base.
Jamie finally summons the courage to ask the obvious question, the one that's digging under our skin.
Why are they here? I mean, why send us if they have Marines?
Just a backup plan, Kit replies.
You know, if things go south, all I have to do is type in the right code and the Marines activate. It takes 6 hours for them to fully recover from the freeze, but after that, they're ready to rock and roll.
Cool, I say, lying through my teeth. The frozen battalion isn't cool. It's just one more sign of Babel's true intentions. So what happens if nothing goes wrong?
Kit shrugs.
Nothing. We ship them back into space and wake them up there. Like I said, they're just a backup plan. If something happens, would you rather be on your own down here or have 70 trained Marines rallying for a rescue mission?
Jamie glances my way before nodding.
It's smart.
Right?
Kit waves us deeper into the chamber.
Come here. This is the best part.
Our footsteps echo. The ghostly faces watch us pass. A shiver runs down my spine as Kit stops us in front of one of the last Marines. He has a narrow face, high cheekbones, and a wash of blonde hair. There's something eerily familiar about him.
Who is he? Jamie asks. A commander or something?
Kit nods up at the Marine.
He's my dad.
I stare at the sleeping soldier in disbelief.
Your dad?
I told you guys, Kit replies. I'm a space brat. Spent almost my whole life out here. Dad and Mom are both with Babel. He's a lieutenant. She's a techie on the space station. Bugs the hell out of her that we're both down here.
Says she doesn't like us in the line of fire.
Kit seems to realize he's been rambling. I watch his eyes trail to the floor before he shrugs his shoulders again.
We should get back. Don't want to throw off the environment down here. I'd hate for my dad to melt because we were dicking around.
He leads us back through the chamber and up the tunnel. I stay quiet, because at least 7 different truths are hammering their way into me. Babel's plans are bigger than we imagined. Kit might think these Marines are some final option that won't get activated, but Babel's too smart for that. My guess is they have more Marines, maybe one more batch at each of their bases. They're already on Imago soil. They're already making preparations. War is coming. And then there's Kit. He's just a kid like us. His dad's down here. His mom is up in space. I keep wanting to slap the toxic waste symbol on Babel and call them what they are, a poison. It's easy to forget that some of their employees have no clue what's really happening. Maybe the Marines do. Maybe they don't. At the end of the day, Defoe and Raquin are the real enemies. More and more, it's feeling like a cut-the-head-off-the-snake situation.
We're going to keep tonight between us, Kit says as we pull ourselves up into the med bay. I really don't care that you were down there, but some of the Babel higher-ups might. I'll keep it out of my reports if you don't talk to everyone else about it. We definitely can't risk the Atomites finding out about any of this.
Tell the Atomites? I ask, smiling. We're smarter than that.
Kit nods again.
You guys want to watch some Illuminats?
Honestly, I'm trying to go back to sleep, I reply. Bad enough I had this clown waking me up to play doctor. Jamie shoots me a well-timed middle finger.
I might hit you up later, though, if it's an open invitation. I never finished the series. Sounds good.
Kit runs a hand through his thick blonde hair.
I'll let you two clean up down here. Sleep well.
He slides back into the hallway. Jamie turns to me, ready to say something, but I silence him with a look. We put everything back in its proper place before moving through the silent tower. The common room is empty now. Parvin and Holly must have found their way back to their rooms. I shiver a little, thinking about those empty eyes. The thought links back to the frozen Marines. There's too much happening. Too many pieces spinning out of our control. We've just made it back to the hive when more movement has us jumping. Anton's door opens, and someone, way too tall to be Anton, slips out. We both stumble back until stray light flashes over Alex's face. He nods at the two of us as he walks past.
Hey,
he says.
Night owls, huh?
He doesn't stop to chat. I stare after him. My first thought jumps right to what Anton and Morning have been brewing. I can't help feeling a little jealous as I watch Alex stroll back through the dark corridors. He's in on their plan, but not me? The idea has me scowling. What was he doing down here? Jamie asks. I shrug it off, remembering I've got my own secrets now. Not sure. Instead of separating, Jamie and I agree to go to his room. It's not hard to piece together Babel's plans with a clue this big. Jamie states the obvious. They want more Zenixia. All the pieces are starting to click neatly into place. They want to get rid of the Imago, I whisper. They want the whole planet. Chapter 12. A Jewel. Emmett Atwater. We're the last team to leave on the second day. Morning lets us sleep in, a reward for pitting two minds in the time it took the other groups to complete one. I was half expecting Holly to be roaming around Foundry fixing windows or something, but Kit informs us that she went obediently with her crew to work the mines. Her unexpected transformation still hangs over the place. I imagine everyone's going to be a little more cautious out at the work sites today. There's some small relief in walking around Foundry without Isadora waiting in every shadow. But now there are other shadows, other games being played. Jamie and I agreed to keep quiet for now, especially inside Foundry. We need to fill Morning and the rest of the crew in on what's happening as soon as possible. But we're also not sure how much we can share in front of Speaker. What if the Imago find out and cut us off entirely? Or maybe they'll decide we deserve the same treatment as Babel's first landing party. As we make our way to the truck, I pull Morning aside. Hey, last night Alex was in Anton's room. He's in on the plan? Morning considers our surroundings, clearly weighing the possibility of being monitored. Let's talk about this later. But why involve him and not me? Morning frowns before realization hits. She starts laughing. You already solved your own riddle. Alex was leaving Anton's room. Right, I reply, after discussing the plan. She rolls her eyes. You really didn't notice? Up in space, Anton and Alex? Anton and Alex? Are together. They like each other. My mind traces back through details. The fear and grief on Anton's face the night we landed. The relaxed look the two of them wore when they safely reunited in Foundry. Really? I can't remember a time that the two of them weren't together up in space. I feel like a lurch now. Subject change? Morning suggests. I nod at her, thankful for an out. How about what we did down in the mine? How the hell did you learn to do that? Morning shrugs. Not much to talk about there. I figured it out about 20 days into the competition. The substance responds to a circular movement. I have no idea why. Jamie leans out of the truck. I realize the rest of the team is already loaded up. When you two finish flirting, I'd like to actually get going, he snarks. We table the talk for now. The third mine has us heading due east. I retreat to the back of the truck, joining Speaker and the others. And our lessons in Imago culture continue. We learn little about everything. The nearest moon, Magnus, is volcanic. Speaker explains that children make a game out of memorizing the changing patterns in the red veins.
At least when there were children, he adds sadly.
He's impossibly patient with us, answering every question. I like that he doesn't just give the bare-bones explanations. He actually teaches us. And his only request is that we teach him in return. When he asks, I have a hard time explaining where I live. It's a big city, I say, with everyone stacked right on top of each other.
And it's called Detroit?
I nod. Motown, the D. I lived there my whole life.
And you said it's like the sixth ring?
He asks. Of all the comparisons, this one makes the most sense to Speaker. The City of Seven set. We studied it on Genesis 11, but Speaker's descriptions have worked to fill in the missing gaps in our education. The Imago first built the Seven Rings for protection. A wall inside a wall inside a wall kind of thing. The outer ring grazes three of the world's five continents, but the inner rings were built over the sea, spread across hundreds of kilometers. Each consecutive ring has a smaller diameter until you arrive at the sanctum, which sits at the center. Speaker informs us that 95% of the Imago live in Sevenset. Hearing that number reminds me, Babel's main plan is attack. If they can expose Sevenset, they're exposing almost the entire population. The game we're playing matters more than I realized. It takes a few minutes to refocus on the present, on the now. Speaker explains that over time, the rings transformed into a ranking system when their duo of queens, the daughters, moved the throne permanently to the sanctum. He doesn't say it directly, but there are enough clues to connect the dots. There aren't many women left in their world. Babel told us they'd stopped reproducing. Is the lack of women the reason why?
When the queens consolidated power, proximity to the sanctum became one of our most valuable commodities, Speaker explains. I was born on the fourth ring. It has taken most of my life to earn my place on the second. One must earn his way forward.
It's a surprise to hear him describe the lower rings with such disdain. Never mind that he came from there and grew up there. His words about the sixth ring leave me annoyed, even a little cold. You know the place I live is like your sixth ring, I explain. Except all of Detroit isn't separated by rings. The people from the different rings all live near each other. And they walk down the street and see people from every ring. If you go downtown, everyone mixes together.
Speaker considers that. Sometimes a person visits another ring, but they cannot live there. So, in Detroit, they live in harmony? The honored and the dishonored? Together?
Not really, I say, picturing the suits and sunglasses on every street corner. No, not really at all. I guess we do live on different rings. But we're so close we have to pretend like we don't. Kids in class would talk about vacations sometimes.
Speaker frowns.
Vacations? Vacations. It's like time off from work. You go to nice places and stuff? My family couldn't exactly afford too many of those, you know? I guess where I come from, you can go your whole life just sticking to people in your ring. And leaving other people to talk to the people in their ring. But I promise you one thing. My neighborhood doesn't have any first ringers, and it's always been that way.
But you can change that, Emmett.
Speaker says confidently.
As with my people. Your people move from ring to ring. You can return as a member of the third or even the first.
That's why I came. Babel offered to take me all the way from sixth to first.
Speaker gasps. Then you must be excited to go home, to take a new place.
I nod half-heartedly. If we make it back. You saw what happened to Holly.
Speaker frowns. An accident. I promise you, Emmett, as I have promised the others, we will do everything in our power to restore Holly. I am hopeful she will recover.
His eyes roam the distant hills. Hoping for a distraction, I ask Azima to tell Speaker about where she grew up. Her face lights up as she describes her family, her younger cousins, and her selfless mother. She describes market tables stacked with passion fruit, cafes that trade in smoke and laughter. I know my corners of Detroit, but it's clear that Azima was and still is the very definition of an explorer. There's not a stone in her old city that she's left unturned. Jamie describes his home, too. Zermatt, a valley town in Switzerland that sits in the shadow of the Matterhorn. Orderly streets, cold winters, roaming tourists. He spends all his time talking about how things work there, all the rules and structure that make the whole place tick like a well-tuned clock. I can tell Babel's betrayal is still gutting him. They've rewritten the rules. And Jamie can't wrap his mind around the fact that they'll do whatever they want to do. We arrive at the mine as Speaker asks Anton about his home. The Russian doesn't answer. He just shakes his head, hops down from the truck, and starts the survey process. Morning distracts us by describing San Jose. She likes the city, but spent all her time in the parks outside it. She describes trees like most people describe their friends. Embarrassed, she digs in a pocket and holds up a smooth stone for us to see.
"It's from my favorite waterfall," she says. "This spot in Alum Rock Park. I couldn't resist bringing a little bit of home with me."
I love learning about mourning, but thinking about home feels like trying to hold on to the wind. Will we ever get back? And when we do, what happens then? I can't help thinking about the possibilities as the third mine gets charted, as our drill digs down 300 meters. I decide to bury the harder questions with it. We spend hours pitting the thing. Nixia rains down through the tunnel, then gets gathered up the conveyor shafts and repackaged for manipulation. We don't break any records, but that's because everyone's a little cautious after Holly's accident. I'm enjoying the mindless work when morning calls me back to the surface. I climb down off the drill and find the others already gathered by the truck's monitor. There's a voice patching through the comm system. Morning's playing with switches, testing this and that, until finally, she gets an image to appear. Parvin's face fills the screen. We didn't even know there was a way to talk to the other crews. She looks exhausted and worried.
"It's Beckway," Parvin crackles. "He left."
Speaker was standing a polite distance away, but the announcement has him rushing over. He looks like he's struggling to find something diplomatic to say, and failing.
"Why would he leave?"
"He didn't tell us," Parvin answers, shaking her head. "He disappeared an hour ago. He took Isadora and Ida with him. They're gone, Morning."
Morning's eyes flick my way. Isadora has made one thing perfectly clear. There's one person she wants to punish. Morning nods over at Anton, and he slips away from the group, circling the grounds. I notice he's carrying both knives at the ready.
"Who are Isadora and Ida? Why them?"
Speaker interrupts.
"Beckway's task was to care for your entire group. There are only a few reasons he would have left some of you vulnerable in favor of protecting others."
Parvin sighs.
"Isadora is pregnant."
There's a moment where Speaker's facial features remain completely motionless. I watch as he processes the information, linking it to Beckway's actions, then moving into the territory of his own response. It's not the first time that I feel like I'm watching an actor pick an emotion for his next scene. When Speaker finally finds the right words, they come stumbling out.
"Can you not see both moons?"
A massive smile splits his face.
"She is with child."
Jamie shrugs. "And that's exciting?"
"I cannot imagine our people being more excited about anything. Long have we discussed your arrival with excitement, but a child would be a jewel in the eyes of our people."
A jewel? The thought has me grinding teeth. Now I know why she left, what she's doing. Isadora might not have performed well in the standings, but I know she's smart. Maybe she weighed the odds of fighting past morning and realized she had no chance on her own. That first night, she swayed some of the Genesis crew, but not all of them. That left one possible option unexplored. The Imago. What happens if they really value the child this much? What status will Isadora be given?
"I'm unfamiliar with human birth cycles. Is the child likely to be born here?"
Azima nods to Speaker.
"She looked like she was already halfway there."
Speaker can't contain his excitement.
"You understand what this means to our people? To host such a miracle would restore hope to even the lowest of our kind. This is a great sign of what is to come, and a great sign of the hope you offer us. It makes sense to me that Beckway would escort her to Sevenset. He should have called for a replacement first, but if Isadora was insisting to be taken to the capital, it was the right decision. Her health is paramount."
Parvin's been listening attentively. Now she pipes back in.
"So you'll take her, but not Holly?"
Speaker swallows before answering.
"Forgive me, but it is a different situation. Holly will not benefit from quicker treatment. Our remedy for her will work or it will not, regardless of the time she receives it. But Isadora? A pregnancy?"
He's so excited he doesn't even have the words to go on. Parvin turns her attention back to us.
Makes sense. Be careful, Morning. You know what she wants. I've talked to her about Emmett. In her mind, all of this ends in blood.
I start to respond, but what can I say? Until we show her Rothi, alive and unharmed, she'll be working to put me in the ground. I knew she'd come for me, but I never imagined she'd come with the weight and blessing of the Imago people behind her. Anton comes back around the truck.
It's all clear. No one in range of our guns.
Morning nods, turning back to Parvin.
Are you heading back to Foundry?
No other choice, Parvin says. It's just the three of us, and I have to keep an eye on Holly the whole time.
Have you let Katsu's team know?
Morning asks.
I don't like the idea of them not knowing what's going on, especially if they could be in danger.
Parvin shakes her head.
I'll link you through to him. We need to get moving.
Copy that,
Morning says.
Be safe.
The screen blinks back to blueprints of the mine. Morning sweeps forward and swipes to a new screen. A little message appears from Parvin. Morning double taps the link and buzzes through to Katsu's squad. It takes about a minute or so, but the display finally patches video footage onto our screen. We get a live feed of a familiar, fog-laced landscape. Our call's been accepted, but the screen is empty.
Where are they? I ask.
Fog swirls, and Morning covers her mouth, gasping. The others crowd around, and we see what she does. Dark forms everywhere. Morning taps the screen, and the shot zooms in on the nearest body. Katsu. My friend stares lifelessly at the screen, all his humor erased in death. A streak of blood runs from lip to chin. Morning pans, and we see Longway half buried in mud. Jazzy is folded over him like an abandoned chair. Alex sits against a distant stone, his shoulders slumped and chin lolling. There's no sign of their fifth teammate, nor. Before any of us can think of something to say, laughter bursts through the audio. Loud and obnoxious laughter. The shot widens, and we watch Katsu double over, his chin shaking as he raises his arms in triumph. Like revenants called back from graves, the entire crew starts to move. We're all staring helplessly when Bally's wide face appears. He's laughing too.
Katsu has taught me the art of a practical joke. Were we successful?
Jesus in heaven,
Anton hisses.
What is wrong with you people?
Bally frowns.
You look upset. In that case, it was not my idea.
Katsu shoulders into the frame.
It was my idea! We've had this planned ever since we found out there was a comm system. So glad you finally called. Totally worth it!
Morning has no words. She shakes her head and stalks off. I see Noor edge onto the screen, her smile bursting out of the circle of her hijab.
I did the fake blood,
she says proudly. Longway leans in too.
I didn't think it was a good idea.
Katsu scowls at Longway before turning back to us.
How's my favorite crew?
As I explain the situation, the humor fades. Their faces are a mixture of sympathy and accusation.
But she wasn't kidnapped or anything?
Noor asks.
Nah, she went on her own. Speaker thinks she'll be celebrated.
Good for her, Katsu says. Bad for you.
All I can do is nod. I'm just glad you assholes aren't dead. Bally shoulders back into the frame.
I just learned that word. It's Katsu's favorite.
I can't help rolling my eyes. It's taken Katsu all of 2 days to convert Bally to his particular brand of humor. After what happened with Holly, did you really think it was time for a fake death joke? Do I need to walk you through how stupid that is? Katsu just shrugs.
My humor is a little too sophisticated for some. I understand.
All I can do is shake my head. Head back to Foundry. We'll meet you there. No more accidents or surprises today. Let's just get back so we can figure out the best move. Be safe. Katsu gives an official-looking salute. Bally mimics him and the feed cuts. The screen reverts to maps as I turn and watch the others make preparations to head home. It feels like a wasted day for everyone, except Speaker, who continues raving about the new life coming to their planet. It's clear that he has no idea just how bad this could be for me. Morning knows, though, and I can see the weight of it riding her shoulders. She sends Jamie up to the front cabin and climbs into the back of the truck with me. Her look is fire and fury.
No matter what happens, she says, I'll fight for you.
Got that? The truck engine revs, and we start to rumble over the nearest hill. Loud and clear. Chapter 13. One Small Step, Emmett Atwater. Our truck rolls back into Foundry in the middle of the afternoon. The timing of the other groups is borderline flawless. Parvin's team follows a few minutes after, and Katsu comes in right on their heels. We're early enough that we catch Kit on the far side of the facility, tending to one of Babel's freshly planted gardens. The entire group gathers as he makes his way over.
When he takes the trucks back to the depot, Morning says, loud enough for the others to hear, I want everyone in the main hall. We need to have a family chat.
There are nods all around. Morning puts on a smile as Kit approaches, confusion clear as day on his face.
Did I miss something? He asks. It's the middle of the afternoon.
Isidore and Ida are gone, Morning answers. Beckway went with them. You can tell Babel that we suspect Isidore is using her pregnancy to gain favor with the Atomites.
Kit's eyebrows just about jump off his forehead.
Gone? Pregnant? What?
You take the trucks and we'll catch you up inside, Morning suggests.
But production...
Kit glances up at the sky again.
We're supposed to use every hour we can to bring Nixia into the facility. That's the job you signed on to do.
Morning nods.
And it's the job we'll continue doing once we've sorted this out. Parvin's team is down to three. Their escort is gone. We need to reorganize.
Kit looks frustrated, but he doesn't offer any solutions either.
I'll get the trucks below, but the bosses are not going to be happy with this. I hope they don't dock your pay.
He walks past the group and accesses the Foundry interface again. We all move toward the entrance, trying to look as casual as we can. Morning strides at the head of the group, glancing back only once to make sure Kit's moving in the opposite direction. The second we're inside, all eyes turn to Morning. I don't know what she's got planned, but Anton walks beside her, and I know whatever it is will be a huge first step in the right direction. She guides us out of sight of the entrance. In one sweeping gesture, she draws the Nixia from her shoulders. The substance expands, misting around us to form a translucent cube that's just big enough to fit all of us inside. I flinch at the snap of static, but it's followed by complete silence. The distant trucks, the snatches of wind, all gone. It's like we're standing in our own private room. Omar clears his throat, and the sound echoes off the Nixian walls. Holly starts to walk toward the shared living space. I can see a pile of dishes there that has caught her eye, but Parvin puts a hand on her shoulder.
Wait, she says. Holly, you're still one of us. Sit, please.
Holly's empty eyes process the command. She glances back at the dishes like she's storing the information for later and decides to sit down. Parvin keeps a steady hand on her shoulder and nods a go-ahead to Morning.
It took me a while to figure out this manipulation, Morning explains, but we can speak freely in here. We can see out of the cube, but Babel can't see in it. They can't hear in it either. My Nixie is jamming every signal. You can all speak freely.
The group shifts uncomfortably. We all trust Morning's ability, but I think the idea of actually dissecting our employer's motivations will always feel dangerous.
When Babel recruited me, they made a lot of promises, Morning starts. I'll admit that I like the idea of being rich. I like the sound of mi abuelita getting the medical treatment she needs. I even like the idea of exploring a new world. But I think we can all agree that Babel hasn't exactly kept their promises.
Most of the group nods. Only Parvin disagrees.
My parents were receiving payments,